Welcome to Dracena Wines Podcast. Our wines plus your moments equals great memories. I'm your host, Lori, and this is a podcast about all things wine. As many of you know, I recently won the Millesima Blog Awards, a highly prestigious award in which the prize was an incredible trip to Bordeaux during the 2017 En Première Week. I have written two blog posts about the experience so far, but I wanted to allow you, my listeners, to hear what one day was like. On this particular day, we had the privilege to visit Xavier Jean, the owner of Couvent des Jacobins in Saint-Emilion. Before we listen in, I wanted to share a bit about Millesima themselves. They are a fine wine retailer that has been in business since 1983. They sell to numerous countries and have locations throughout the world. Their New York City store opened in 2006, and although I haven't been there yet, it is definitely on my list to walk through those doors in the very near future. I hope you enjoy learning about Couvent des Jacobins from the owner himself. Sláinte!
Been about 1,500 years or so that wine has been made in Saint-Emilion, and then in the 1200s, 1300s, a number of monastery orders came into Saint-Emilion. So the first one was the Cordelier, the Franciscan, and then you had the first one of the Jacobin, which is a different kind of monk order that had its first couvent at the entrance of Saint-Emilion, where you have the old ruins just at the entrance next to the roundabout. The thing burnt, and then in 1380, they actually came to Saint-Emilion. They were given this big plot of land where the king at the time gave them the possibility to establish the order. So the Dominican monks, they are a bit different from the others insofar as they actually go towards people. So they are not cloistered in a specific place, like the Cistercian order, for example. You know, these guys, they just stay within their thing and then they just don't speak and they don't talk and they don't see each other. So that's not the case with the Dominican brothers. They actually go towards the poor, they help the poor, they kind of, you know, do charity work, and then they actually were making wine at the time. So the establishment of the place was in between 1380 and 1390. So we have a plaque that dates from 1389. So that's why we give this approximate time for the establishment of the order, the second couvent des Jacobins within Saint-Emilion. It's called Jacobin because these people, even though it's the Dominican Brotherhood, they had their origin in the street in Paris called Saint-Jacques. So Saint-Jacques, Jacobin, so they became known as the Jacobin Brotherhood.
Is it related to the Claude des Jacobins, my history?
No, it's very different. So Claude des Jacobins, they got this name, I think, in the 1950s.
Ah, yes, so it's
so it's quite disconnected. Yeah, so that's the place where the old monk couvent or monk old convent was back in the days. So the estate is quite unique for a number of reasons. One, this is located within Saint-Emilion, and you know, in Saint-Emilion, most of the estates are located outside of the walls of the city. So besides the fact that it has quite a few technical challenges, because you have to do everything within a very tiny space, you know, we are lucky to have the aging cellar, which you will see in 30-45 minutes, the harvest reception, the aging, and we have underground caves because, as you may know, Saint-Emilion is like a gruyère. It's been exploited for many decades and many centuries for the stones that were giving, you know, the beautiful kind of stones of Bordeaux, Libourne, and Saint-Emilion. So the city of the houses were built using this limestone. And then, as you will, I will tell you about later, in the 60s, they stopped doing this because it was becoming too dangerous. So all the empty spaces beneath the city was actually used for wine storage because the conditions, as you will see, are ideal in terms of temperature and in terms of humidity. So the whole thing of the family is contained here. So the monks, they stayed from 1380 plus to 1780. So at the French Revolution, as you might remember, so between 1380 and 1780, so during the French Revolution, at the French Revolution, everything stopped. So what happened is the political situation at the time was obviously very challenging, right? And the Jacobins, they had been opposed at that time to the current administration of France. And what because they were religious and religion was still very important at the time, what the people of the administration did is they kind of brought back a lot of the bad things that the Jacobin brothers did in terms of, you know, participating in like religious assaults and all these kind of things. So the order was dissolved in the 1780s. So the Jacobin brothers had to leave the place. And between 1780 and 1800s, the place was sold as it's called the Bien National in French. So basically, the state nationalized the place and then sold it. And between 1800 and 1902, there was two families that owned the place, the Vautier and the Gadet. And then my family, the Jean family, bought it in 1902. So that's a little bit of a history of the estate. And I mean, your family is trying to maintain is really the history of the place. So we've been there for, you know, 500 or 600 years, and it's probably going to be there, hopefully, after me, for another 500 or 600 years if we still produce wine in Saint-Emilion. So the idea is to try to kind of keep the history and keep the kind of everything that was before us, and, you know, build on it, and then pass it to the next generation if we can, or if I can, pass it to the next generation. So the idea is not to kind of dramatically change with every generation, because we've actually known quite a few generations since we started, but more kind of build on it and then try to make it better than the way we received it a couple of decades ago.
In this next segment, we learn about the terroir within Saint-Emilion and specifically about the soils in the vineyards of Couvent des Jacobins.
And as a result, the number of wine growers was a lot bigger also. So there's thousands of wine growers in Saint-Emilion. And the estate size tends to be a bit like in Burgundy, just a few hectares. A few hectares meaning that we will produce at Couvent des Jacobins in an average year about 2,000 cases per year. So that's about 25 to 26,000 bottles. So that's 5 to 10 times less than what you could see in the other regions, in Bordeaux especially. So as far as the estate is structured, so one of the specificities of Couvent des Jacobins, that's due to the location of the place, so where we are, we don't have our plots nearby the estate. And the family has gone through, you know, transmissions and successions and different weddings and all these things. So over the past 115 years of ownership, we've been adding acreage over time in different areas of Saint-Emilion. So there's effectively three big blocks where our estates, the grapes are located, so the vines are located. One is the limestone plateau just on the other side of the wall. That's probably one, if not the best terroir in Saint-Emilion, because what you effectively have is the rock, about 30 centimeters to 1.5 meters just below the surface, and then you have clay. And what that gives to the wine is a minerality and, you know, some kind of freshness and so on that is quite difficult to get if you just have soil. Why? Because the roots, you know, the roots of the vines, they actually go very deep, sometimes 2 to 3 meters deep, because it's like, you know, it's like a vine, right? So when they touch the rock, they can't go further because it's hard, and they actually start spreading on the rock. And as you know, one of the characteristics of, you know, the soil and the terroir is generally what the roots get, then it fills into the fruits, and then if it fills into the fruit, then it's going to fill into the wine. So having, you know, acreage on the plateau is something that's very qualitative for the vines, because even in small quantities, it does provide a bit of a kicker to the wine. It provides freshness, it provides minerality, it provides sophistication, it provides really something that's quite unique and that builds the identity. So that's one of the blocks. The second big block is on the southwest slope of Saint-Emilion. So if you go outside of the village and then you go towards Libourne, And I'll give you a couple of chateaus, just maybe you know them so that you kind of understand. So Saint-Emilion is like a big hill. So we are here at the top of the village. Libourne is here, and then you arrive, I think, through the roundabout, which is just here. So our second acreage is on the southwest slope, so it's around here. And you will have, just opposite, you have Angelus, you have Bellevue, you have Grand Main, and you have a couple of classified estates that have the acreage there.
That's where we entered this morning.
Oh, possibly. Oh, yeah, if you came through that, yeah, if you came through that road.
The driver was smart enough to give us a quick tour.
Yeah, so if you come through that road, then on the right you have Angelus, and on the left you have the hill, so we're just right before that on the slope. So that's the second big block. Then the third big block is about a kilometer away on a little cliff. There's a little, we call it a little slope, a little croupe, that is also quite qualitative. It historically formed the body of Couvent des Jacobins because it's clay with a little bit of limestone. So generally, the clay is actually providing a muscle. It's providing, because it's very rich soil, so it provides muscle, it provides power, it provides tannins, it provides quite a bit of clout to the wine. And then limestone only and sand, it tends to provide more the finesse because they tend to be slightly poorer soils, and then they complement very well. So what's a bit unique with Couvent is because we have these different plots a little bit all over the place. The wine is not a one-size-fits-all wine, for example, when you just have, you know, one big plot of clay or one big plot of limestone or one big plot of sand. So the complexity of managing the estate is trying to understand each of the different plots, but not to a level of, 2 hectares or 3 hectares, but to a level of, sometimes half an hectare. So the kind of, the way we are trying to work towards is how to combine all these different plots that is quite unique in Saint-Emilion and make a wine that is coherent and whose identity you can feel from vintage to vintage. We have 14 different types of subsoils within the estate. So from the big blocks that I was telling you, then you will have variations. Yeah, in some places you will have more clay than sand. In some places the proportion is going to be the reverse. Then if you have the limestone, sometimes you have clay on top, and then sometimes you have a bit of sand on top or sandy clay on top. So if you kind of take these three big blocks, generally you have a lot of variations also within it. So that's a big challenge, because when you think about it, you have 2 or 3 grape varieties, then you have maybe 10 or 15 different types of soils, then you have maybe 3 or 4 different types of tonneliers, the people who make the barrels. And then when you kind of multiply all these things, you have, hundreds and hundreds of different possibilities. Yeah, maybe I put Merlot here, and then for this Merlot, maybe I harvest at this time, and then maybe this crop, I put it in this kind of oak, and so on. So you could just kind of multiply the different possibilities. And for the past, decades and decades, we're just trying to find what's the most optimal way of combining all these different plots to make a wine that is, highly qualitative and also has a bit of an identity. So we don't want to make the same wines than anyone, because anyway, it's very simple to make a great wine in a great year. Yeah, everybody does it. Yeah, 15 and 16, everybody can make great wines. The challenge is going to be in years where the climate is really horrible, or when it's, like a big freeze like in 2017, or where there's a lot of sun like in 2003, is how you kind of develop the consistency of your product throughout vintages. When you just have one big plot that's next to your chateau and there's just one characteristic, typically it's more simple than if you just have a collection of different things all over the place. Yeah. So there's a big focus on that on our end.
In the following 2 segments, we learn how Couvent des Jacobins worked to become organic and how they believe that it takes time to let the vines learn and understand the new system. We then discuss a very specialized fermentation and aging vessel that was made specifically for them, known as the Pearl.
A winemaker, we kind of started thinking about the next thing as far as environmental things were concerned, And the thing is, you can't decide to wake up one day and to turn organic. It just doesn't work because the grapes, the vines, they've been used to having, you know, a little bit of fertilizers, a little bit of protection. Yeah, so it's like a junkie. So you, I mean, there's different. There are different schools.
Better descriptors.
There are different schools as far as junkies are concerned. Some people think that you should sever immediately.
Yeah.
And some people think
that's
that
right.
It has
so
to be more
gradual.
Yeah, to want to
you
wind
diminish
it up.
The dose. Right.
So I'm not really quite sure about what's the right way to do. That's probably depend on the psyche and all stuff. But it's the same concept with vines. And therefore, vines, we know that it doesn't work. You can't go from one year to another with nothing, okay? Because then it's just going to be catastrophic. So the way we've been doing is since 2010, you start reducing a little bit the different bits and pieces. So you stop using one particular product. You stop using the antibiotics, for example, these things. You start reducing the doses of copper that you put in the crop, in the vine, to kind of reduce the protection. And then what we have observed is the vine, they get used to it. So they demand a bit less, yeah? So let's say 1 year you grow 5 kilograms per hectare, and then the year after 4.5, and then you notice that it doesn't suffer more, so then you go down to 4, and then to 3.5, and all these things. So the going gradual is really critical. Since last year, so we've gone the organic certification route, and as you might remember, it takes 3 plus 1 years, so effectively 4 years before you get the certification for the organic certification. So my secret objective is to get the triple JAS, EcoCert, and USDA, but that's going to be really very tough. In the vineyard, we are very comfortable that we can do it now. So it's been 3 years already, so we have another 2 years to kind of transform the trial and get certification. But what people don't understand sometimes is organic certification is not only reducing the products that you put in the vineyard, yeah, it's also limiting what you put inside the wine, especially as far as sulfites are concerned. Okay, you know, so the sulfites, they help preserve the wine. For organic certification, EcoCert, for example, the max that you can use is 90 microgram per liter. So today we are well below this, but my recollection is, for example, USDA certification requires even less. And natural wines, you know, wines without sulfites, you just don't know how they're going to evolve from time to time. So you always need at least a little bit just to make sure that the thing gets preserved. So there's a lot of different kind of boxes that, let's say, USDA certification requires that EcoCert, which is the European organic certification, doesn't require. So one of the things we hope to be working towards is getting the 3 certifications at some point, maybe in 22 or in 25 or things like that. But the idea is just to try to get the overall philosophy is really to try to get as much as little human influence in whatever product you produce as possible. Even though there's going to still be a lot of kind of, you know, decision making that's made by the human and so on, but we just want to kind of keep the wine as not as raw, but as natural as possible from what you harvested when you harvest it. We are doing a few things of biodynamic, but I think we're not going necessarily toward that direction at the moment. But then there's a few powders that they use in biodynamic thing, like 501 and 500 or something like this, which is like the silex that, you know, you kind of crush and then you spread all over. So this we are using. So there's a few things that we are using, but then cutting at specific times or, you know, when the moon is rising, all these kind of things, we haven't kind of tried and tested at this stage. So we prefer first kind of being very comfortable with this whole organic way, because it's, once again, it's not only in the vineyard, but it's also in the winemaking process that can be a bit challenging. And then once we are well anchored and well kind of experienced, then we might actually move towards the next
thing. And how many producers are organic in Saint-Emilion?
Okay, so not little. So our benchmark is the Grand Cru Classé and the first classified. Yeah, so it's the classified estates and the first classified, because we are classified estate. And very unfortunately, there's very few classified estates that are organic. There's a handful. So we are 60 classified estates. I think there's 3 or 4 that are organic only. Yeah. And the classified estates, you know, they sell their wine more expensive. We are supposed to be producing quality wines, wines that can age. We tend to have more financial resources and so on. So it's really a shame that, you know, the small producer that's just a Saint-Emilion Grand Cru or a Saint-Emilion is making tremendous effort to go towards the organic route and gets organic certification when the people who should actually be able to bear the cost financially or not. So that's, we're trying to kind of, you know, encourage and move towards towards this and kind of set an example that, you know, we could afford it. And even if you lose the crop 1 year, then, you know, we'll just do with it. When the small producers are just making so much effort and they get really very little for their wines. So that's very unfortunate.
Aging the barrels, new barrels like this, 225 liters. And the new concept here is to also use a new form of barrels like this, the perle in French, perle. And we have 400 liters inside. We're using for the vinification and after for the aging. The first part is used for the petit verre d'eau, because maybe we spoke about the blend. We have a petit verre d'eau, Cabernet Franc, and Merlot. And we do the vinification of the petit verre d'eau inside of the perle. It's a typical natural Burgundy techniques, like pigeage. We use we move the cap by hand, only by hand, no moving by pumps or other. We just use by hand, and we do the vinification for the petit verre d'eau for 25-30 days inside. And after that, when we are finished to rack the wine separately, we've done the separately pumping, we clean the perle and we use for the second label or for the aging of the first label. It's for the Couvent des Jacobins or Menu des Jacobins used for the aging. Now in 2007 we use for the second label, Menu des Jacobins. But normally we age the separately the different grape variety, the Merlot, the Cabernet Franc, and the Petit Verre are aged separate in different type of wood, like new wood for 1 year, barrel, or pearl.
And you use only Petit Verre for this?
Yeah. Normally we aging the Petit Verre separately on the Cabernet Franc and the Merlot. But for this year, the 2007, we blended the Petit Verre, Cabernet Franc, and Merlot together. Because it was a so small production. Yeah. And to the petit verre d'eau, the degree, alcohol degree of the petit verre d'eau in 2007 was 15.5, 15.2, 15.5 degrees, alcohol degrees. And we can age a wine to 15 separately for the petit verre d'eau. We have to blend it before. The Merlot is a 14 degrees. And blended is a quite to 14.5, 14.6 degrees in alcohol. Because we change it, sometimes we're changing the age, the type of age.
I understand the benefit of fermenting in this, but what's the benefit of aging in this shaped barrel compared to...
Is the contact with the wood. Here you have a warm...
This you have less...
You have less wood. Oaky taste, oaky nose also in the wine because the wood is just for 400 liters, is for 200 liters. And you have quite the same proportion of wood, but more liter inside. Less oaky taste, nose, sure. And also is interesting for the micro oxygenation of the wine. Because through the wood, you have one part of the oxygen coming inside and the wine. Because we it's more just in this kind of wood like or about.
Okay, now it's time for you to get seriously jealous. We were treated to a vertical tasting of Couvent des Jacobins wines starting with a 1953. Yes, you heard me right. It was then followed by a 1964, 1975, 1982, 1998, and a 2006. Following, you will hear Dennis Pomerade describe each vintage. This was an experience that I will remember for the rest of my life. These wines changed my opinion of old world wines. They have instilled a new love for wines that I never thought I would adore, and have taught me what having patience can mean in terms of storing wine and allowing them to evolve to the fullest. Never would I have thought I would taste a wine as old as 1953. But wait, with lunch, Dennis opened a 1949. And let me tell you, that wine sang.
Try to maybe 40, 42 hectoliters by hectare only. It's not the same proportion of Merlot Cabernet Franc than today, than the new vintage. 75% Merlot, 25% Cabernet Franc.
Okay.
Small production, very classical vintage here in Couvent Jacobin. Remember that the 53, you don't have any thermal regulation group, you don't have any stainless steel tank, it's a concrete tank like this. You see in the cave, no table regulation, no selection table, no small packet cagette for that. It was only horse, big, we say, comment on peut dire les douilles, à l'époque c'était encore les douilles en bois, tu sais, les comportes en bois.
C'est quoi les comportes?
C'est des douilles, c'est des grosses comportes en bois comme des grosses bassines en bois. On remplissait, on mettait sur les charrettes. Il faut penser qu'à cette époque-là, ça n'a rien à voir avec la technologie.
Oh yeah, no, so what Dennis is saying is that back in the days, the way to make wine was just completely different. So I mean, everything related to bottling and vatting and so on, I mean, it was not like necessarily closed space. It was like big containers where you had the wine inside. And there was less, I think, attention necessarily being paid to oxygenation and, you know, the risk of oxidation and all these things. So they were just making it really really craftsmanship and really artisanal rather than obsessed with technique and controlling oxygen and controlling this.
Because they don't know about it.
Because they didn't know. The first vintages of Madame Blanc?
Yes, I think it's the first. Though.
It's the first, yeah. So yeah,
it's amazingly fresh.
Sweet spices also.
Dennis, how long have you been caring for the wine here?
22 is my 22 vintage. And I started my first vintage, not here, it was 91. The frost vintage also.
Oh boy, Rudolph.
It was in Médoc, not here in Saint-Denis. Marco.
One thing that we want to have in our wines is enough energy after a period of time. Because Grand Cru Classé, they are supposed to be wines that can age. Yeah. So you should be able to drink as a consumer a Grand Cru Classé after 10 years or 15 years and still feel the energy, the power, the balance, some, you know, great pleasure, and the feel that, yes, this is a wine that has aged, and, you know, I'm actually happy to have made the investment of buying a Grand Cru Classé. So if there was really one thing, and one of the important attributes of aging is that you need the wines to be still fresh and energetic and, you know, have some kind of peps, as we say in French, in the mouth. And the issue is if the wines are harvested with, let's say, too much alcohol, or they are too ripe, or, you know, this kind of, that you put too much oak or things like that, they have a risk of falling off after a couple of years. Mm-hmm. Either because there is no freshness anymore, or just because it's just very boring after a while.
The acidity is incredible.
So acidity is something that we, you can't have too much, but that's something that we are interested in preserving. And when there was this big fashion about, you know, overpowered wines and wines that tended to be very jammy and extremely structured and so on, we've never really quite I would say, followed that approach because we, once again, were not sure the way they would age. And also, it's the type of wine that we don't really like so much. So the idea is really to keep a bit of energy in the wine. Yeah.
Before, different vintage, different year, is quite drier, more drier than this 53. Ultimate was different.
64 is drier than 53.
And the production is around of 52 hectoliters per hectare. More production, but drier climate. Good harvest time with a good sun. And the Cabernet Franc, the people write at that. Cabernet Franc was so interesting at that time for the freshness of the Cabernet Franc and the paper nose of the Cabernet Franc. Normally it's still fresh. Aged in barrel. Maybe at that time it was 20-25% of new wood only. No, 40-50%, 20-25% of new wood. New oak, and age for 12 months, the same of today, 12-15 months. And bought not underground. I think in 64 it was bought in the cave's top, in the place of the tank. And after the end of the 70s, we started to build in the ground. After the 60, 74, 75, we built in underground.
And what did you say
you blend
the
approximately? Quite the same 70-75% Merlot. Quite the same proportion of the 53. The people at that time were not changing the blend. They just organize the record, the harvest time, and do the vinification, and normally it's compared to the plant. 75% Merlot and 75% Merlot in the blend.
And where would these vineyards be? Is this also a mix, or is this when you had?
At that time, 1764, it was maybe 4 or 5 hectares only.
On the plateau?
One on the plateau, one part. Now we planted in Cabernet Franc 2 years ago. Castelbourse, where was the Petit Verdot now, it was a Merlot before. And the part of Chateau Angelus area, it was planted in Merlot and just a few parcels in Cabernet Franc.
It's amazing because you can feel this warm vintage, like it still only has traces of fruit, you know, it's still a very same blue wine,
exactly.
But you can feel that there's a very different vintage happening.
Very, very different.
Very different.
Yeah.
And if you don't know the year, not sure you say 64.
Oh, no.
So many people say for that kind of wine, that kind of year, say 82,
yeah, it feels
85.
Not 64.
And in the mouth, for the 64. In the mouth as well. Wow. You get a lot in the mouth, you get much more tannin and acidity than the previous vintage that we tried. It feels much younger.
The 70s, the period of the 70s, the people knew more technology for extraction. There were some machines to extraction, new pumps and other. And I think for the 75 year, they have extract more tannins inside and it's a little bit more rustic in the end when you taste the wine. And the people don't know exactly the limit, how to extract, how to do the wines. Compared on the 80s, after in the 80s they know more and more about analysis, about the wines, and they have experience. In 70, particularly in 72, 73, the people doesn't know anything about the wines. They just want to produce quantities. 73 was the petrol
crisis, yeah.
And the people produce in quantities, but not qualities. And the 75 is the start to change it, or the quality and not the production. And in this kind of 75, you have more fresh, more structured wines, and some tannins, big tannins at the end of the mouth, too much tannins for me.
But then it's weird how, 15 years before that, nobody really cared. You kind of taste the wine, and then you mix and match, and then, you bottle, and that's it, you sell. And then in the mid-70s, you start having a bit more ideas about the techniques. And then in 80s and 90s and 2000s, yeah. I mean, the technique evolved. So before, you could just say, okay, maybe the color is this level, so I want it a bit more, so then I extract maybe for another 2 days or 5 days or whatever. Then in the 70s, they didn't really quite get that right.
So just
just starting.
On the 75, 76, to learn about the extraction, about the maceration, the time of maceration, the temperature control, so... It's the starter of the Bordeaux wines technology, 75, 76. Before it was just, we're making wines, good wines, good parcels, give good wines, and sometimes it's wrong, sometimes it's good, depend on the...
And then from one bottle to another, maybe there was a lot of variation also.
Yeah. Remember that the 60s, period 60s, the people do the bottling each power. Different. They're aging the barrel, they don't blend in the barrels at the end in the tank. They put the wine in the bottle from each barrel.
Oh.
You can have a change, one is changing one barrel to another barrel. After the 70s, industry is coming in the winery, and you have a big tank, like a concrete tank, but also a stainless steel tank arrived. It was the start of the 70s. But before, it was only barrel. Barrel for barrel.
Right, because you didn't have the ability to...
No, it was just too difficult. Yeah. I mean, you could have like 10 strong guys kind of carrying the barrel and not putting it back and all together.
You can find some pictures, our pictures, the people who just corking by hand.
I've done that. For...
It's fun for the first couple of bottles.
For like maybe 60. The 10 bottles. And
yeah.
And hand labeling? No.
Yeah, hand labeling. 70s, it was the starter, the industry, energy industry.
Sorry, what did you say? It was
80? 82, maybe the proportion of the new barrel is 40-45% of the new oak.
You're looking for something.
Yes.
Sorry. 82. 82. Sorry.
The year that made Mr. Parker's career.
Mercy.
But 82 is one of the best years in the 80s. It was dry, so dry climate, hot temperature, problems with temperature control in the cellars and the wineries. So many people buy ice. From Saint-Emilion to Libourne.
It's in the
take the ice in the small buckets and put in the tank to preserve the temperature control because it was so faster and the fermentation. It was six, eight days fermentation only. Now we have 10, 12 days. 6, 8 days is a very fast for the fermentation, but very fast for the people to do the pumping. They have to do more and more and more to be in the same time for the extraction. Merlot Cabernet Franc also, no Petit Verdot inside. In this vintage, we was in the 22% of Cabernet Franc in the 80, 70, 22, 78% Merlot. Aging barrel for 15 months aging, and the new barrels is 45. about 40-35% of new barrels. And a very classical, 98 was a classical, and during the harvest time we wait a long time the maturity of the Cabernet Franc. Cabernet Franc was so interesting for the freshness and also the fresh paper and some cloves, you say cloves, nerves, and the Cabernet Franc. And the Merlot was so fresh fruits, nose of a mulberry, blackcurrants at that time. It was my third vintage. I started in 96, 97, 98 was my third. And we introduced in 98 the micro-oxygenation in the Merlot. It was the start of the micro-oxygenation technology. With Stéphane Renoncourt, I was with Stéphane Renoncourt at that time to introduce in Saint-Emilion the micro-oxygenation that time in the Merlot. And small production, 98 produced 38 hectoliters by hectare, very small, but a good quality for the Merlot and the Cabernet Franc. 98 is one of the classical vintages in Saint-Emilion, they're one of the best balance in Saint-Emilion.
It's a splendid one. I love it.
I love it.
Because
you
can feel like the grapes were very ripe and everything, but you get a backbone acidity that is beautiful.
It's a bit of freshness.
Yeah.
So when you bottle, you do the percentage that you do only in bottle and the rest in magnum, or what's the... You have a rule, or?
300 to 600 magnum.
Okay.
Maximum.
Per vintage. Yeah.
Per vintage. Depends on the year, but 300, 600 maximum.
You don't want rules in wine growing. It's better to have flexibility in general.
O6 is a blend of 85% Merlot and 15% Cabernet Franc. O6 is very classical compared to 98, is the same climate, same production. The yield is about 42-43 hectoliters hectare maximum. At that time, aging is quite the same also, 13-14 months in barrel. New oak for 45% new oak. And if you compare on the others vintage, it can be similar to the 2008-2011.
And what was the climate?
2006 was harder for the Cabernet Franc, wet, so humid at the bed of Cabernet Franc harvest, but really good for the Merlot. Merlot time was, I think it was 24-25 of September we started the harvest for the Cabernet, for the Merlot. And we wait to Cabernet Franc at the 10th of October.
For me, it does have a richness of fruit. So I'm really surprised that you say it was a white vintage.
Yeah, it's still young. It's still young for the fruits. And 2006 was so close, 2 years ago, butter. And now it's just starting to be open. For me, 2006 is a surprise. Because 2006, nobody tells about 2006. We're speaking about the 2008, the 2004, and 2006. Nobody is talking about 2006. It's very classical. And so many people don't talk about it. But it's very classical, but very interesting for the balance and the fruits and the preserve. Yeah, soft.
I know that hearing the history of Cuvée de Jacobin and listening to the winemaker describe the vintages cannot equal the actual experience of being there and tasting these incredible wines. But I hope that this podcast was able to give you a little insight and a lot of desire to visit Bordeaux, Saint-Emilion, and especially Couvent des Jacobins. I want to again thank Melisma for arranging the visit, Xavier for sharing his family's history and providing exceptional wines and food, and Dennis for providing us with the technical information about each of these wines. Sláinte. Did you know that Dracena Wines now has a wine club? We named it the Chalk Club. Draco is on our label, but Vegas was getting a little jealous, so we decided he deserved to be our club spokesdog. In Las Vegas, betting chalk means that you are betting on all of the favorites. We are betting that we are one of your favorite wineries, so we thought the name was apropos. The club is simple, yet a bit different than most. When you wager on us, we will ship you 3 bottles of wine twice a year, once in April and once in September. You can choose all red or mix of red and rosé. You immediately receive 15% off of all your wine purchases throughout the year, but what makes our club stand out is the progressive discount. Let your club membership ride into the next year. Your discount increases. Each year you parlay your membership, you receive an additional 5% off up to a planned maximum of 25%. Your club shipments are discounted to a flat $15, plus we'll cover your club shipping cost for your second shipment. That's $15 house money in a sure bet for you. So please head to our website, dracenawines.com, and find out all of the benefits of joining the Chalk Club and how to sign up. We've stacked the odds so that you can get our award-winning wines without breaking the bank. Thanks for listening to Dracena Wines Podcast. If you have suggestions on what topics you would like us to discuss, please reach out to us on social media. You can find us on Twitter, Instagram, Pinterest, YouTube, Facebook, Snapchat, Google, and Periscope as @DracenaWines. I am also on LinkedIn as Lori Hoyt Budd, or email us at dracenawines.com. If you enjoyed our podcast, please subscribe and leave us a review on your favorite podcast catcher to help others find us more easily. We are found on all of your favorite aggregators. To subscribe easily to iTunes, go to bit.ly/Dracena Podcast. That's bit.ly/Dracena Podcast, and that's a capital D for Dracena and capital P for podcast. Please check out our award-winning wines and find out about our wine club at dracenawines.com. And remember to always pursue your passion. Sláinte.